On Tech News Today, the NSA can't handle the metadata, crowdfunding science, and watch out for the California kill switch. All that and more come out next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
It's Friday, February 7th, 2014, and this is Tech News Today. Tech News Today is sponsored by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT2. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
I'm Sarah Lane.
And I'm Tanya Hall.
And Tech News Today explores the top tech news in 30 minutes or less. We'll see if we can do that. Well, have you got that Olympic fever?
I do.
Yeah, do you? You know, one of the funnest things about the Olympics so far is the Sochi problems hashtag and Twitter handle.
You're enjoying that from afar?
I kind of am. It's unfair. And it's wrong. I mean, they're doing their best, and it's probably going to be a great Olympics. But yeah, there's something about social media that likes to bring out the worst in everybody. But I'm enjoying it. Anyway, well, the Wall Street Journal reported this morning in an exclusive that the NSA does not collect phone metadata for most wireless phone calls. It does collect the data on landline calls. So in total, the paper estimates that the NSA collects just 20% of the possible metadata on phone calls overall. The reason, according to the journal's sources, is that it's just too much metadata. And I don't know about this. I mean, it kind of rings true that they are unable to keep up with the massive amounts of data. I think people kind of give the NSA credit for being more competent than they really are.
Yeah, I mean, I think the potential, the fact that the NSA has the potential to be listening to my specific phone conversation or reading my specific correspondence in writing or via email, that's what gets everybody riled up. The reality, though, is that most of this is just going to be thrown away. And that's not a good thing either. I mean, I guess you could say, well, it's very unlikely that my personal privacy is being compromised. But with all of that huge, huge, huge amount of data, when the whole point of it is to find bad guys and gals, well, if you can't actually make use of that huge dump of information, it's not good for anybody.
Well, and what kind of permission are we actually giving them? I get, you know, that, after 9/11, you know, the terrorist attacks, that we made a lot of significant changes to protect ourselves. But we're also giving up a lot of freedom. And so even if they're not collecting it, what do they have permission to do in the future?
Well, that's actually a sticky question because, in fact, we give them permission through our government, which includes, of course, the Congress. And the Atlantic Monthly confirmed yesterday that the NSA, quote, probably, unquote, surveils the phones of Congress. So if Congress people are doing things they shouldn't be doing, which is likely, if we know politicians, then the NSA knows about it. And so it's just the whole thing just kind of is not good.
Also, if there is a bunch of information that's maybe being collected and put somewhere, so not it thrown out entirely, but we'll get to this when we get to this type of a thing, how much time can go by where you might have somebody knocking on your door 5 years from now saying, there was something really weird about this correspondence? I think there needs to be some sort of a time frame. Hey, if you want to collect the information, you better deal with it in a timely fashion.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're going to hear about how Apple, unlike other companies which are buying other companies, like Google's always buying other companies, Apple is buying its own company. We can hear about that in a sec. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. These guys are doing some exciting things. This is a really, really cool company. We told you before the Super Bowl that they had this really cool Super Bowl ad, and you can check this out at the page you see here. At the Squarespace blog, blog.squarespace.com, and run the video. It's an awesome ad. I love this ad, and the reason I like it is because it's so true. Their point is that the internet is ugly, cacophonous, noisy, obnoxious, and full of spam and junk. But if you create a website on Squarespace, you'll create an oasis of beauty and elegance because they have incredible designs. In fact, they have not 20, but 25 templates on the site. They've also added a logo creator. So if you're a small business person and you need a logo, Squarespace will help you create that logo at no additional charge. This is a really, really great service. And you can find out about their logo creator also on blog.squarespace.com. Just go to the blog and check out both of these two new additions. These are really cool things. Now, if you use Squarespace and you have a question or something you don't understand, they give you tech support 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by either email or live chat. I've used both their live chat and their email support, and both of them are really, really good. Plus, there's a completely redesigned customer help site where they have self-help articles and video workshops. So they'll actually help train you to become an awesome manager of your website, awesome blogger, to do things that you didn't think were possible. And of course, so many things are possible on Squarespace because it's so incredibly easy to use. It's also really inexpensive. Starts at just $8 a month, and this includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. The new Squarespace Metric app for iPhone and iPad lets you check site stats like page views, unique visitors, and social media follows. And there's a blog app, too, that lets you make text update tap and drag images and change layouts, monitor comments, do all the things you normally do when you manage a blog. So this is a fantastic, fantastic service. And you can just go there and try it. You can go to the site right now, squarespace.com, create a website in just a few minutes, and then you can see what that website looks like, and I think you're going to be blown away. I certainly was when I first tried it, and I've loved this site ever since. So start a free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT2 because that'll give you 10% off, and it'll also show your support for Tech News Today. We thank Squarespace for their support of this show, and remember that a better web awaits, and it starts with your new Squarespace website. Well, Apple is buying itself. What's going on?
Yes. So Apple CEO Tim Cook has told the Wall Street Journal that the company has bought $14 billion of its own shares in the 2 weeks since reporting its latest financial results that, while they were record-breaking, ended up disappointing the market. So if you collect all of these buybacks, Apple has now bought back more than $40 billion of its own shares over the past 12 months, which is nearing the previously disclosed goal to repurchase $60 billion of its own shares. So it's on track. It's not too far away now. Cook says that Apple plans to disclose updates to its buyback program in March or April. So it's, in essence, what this means is Apple says we have enough confidence in what we have for our roadmap for 2014 and beyond that the stock fell a little bit. All right, well, we're going to go ahead and bring that back into the company, which not only gives the company leverage for future acquisitions, where stock might be a really attractive thing to offer a company that's being acquired, but also future buyback programs for investors, which Apple has been under a little bit of fire over the last 12 months or so to do something with this cash pile, to do something for the people who own part of the company.
Right. And of course, saying that they believe in the company and they're sort of investing in their own company is the positive spin. The negative spin is that they're worried about their stock price. They're kind of propping it up by purchasing it. And, it's a reasonable thing to do. They're a highly secretive company. Tim Cook constantly says we've got amazing things coming, whole new categories, but then he won't tell anybody anything about exactly what those are. And of course, I think people are losing confidence because they say that a lot, and then we really haven't had new categories or bold new products since 2010.
But I think that we're going to see that. I think this is part of that strategy. I think they are getting ready to do something really big that they've been on the cusp for a while. I think everybody's watching to see what they do in the TV space. I think we're watching to see what's going to happen in wearable tech. I think it's time for them to do something really big, and they've been keeping it under wraps. I think this is a part of that intro to the new Apple.
That's a good point. And we're going to hear about a new way to fund science, aren't we, Tanya?
We are. A startup for crowdfunding science launches today. It's called Experiment.com, just like Kickstarter or Indiegogo and Rocket Hub, but for science. And it essentially gets grants from the public.
Well, with us to explain themselves are the three founders of Experiment.com. Can you introduce yourselves, please?
Sure. I'm Skander.
Hi, I'm Denny.
And I'm Cindy.
Cindy, you're the CEO, is that right?
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Before you tell us about Experiment.com, can you tell us a little bit about your science backgrounds?
Yeah, so I was a researcher at the University of Washington. I was funded by Howard Hughes Medical Institute when I was 19 years old, and I worked in immunology and synthetic biology.
Okay, and the rest of you?
Yeah. So I was also working in research, and it was actually our time in research together at the University of Washington, where we were actually working on a side project where we developed a enzyme therapeutic for anthrax. And so we used a video game called Foldit to design this enzyme. And the strategy that we'd used out at that time, Cindy wanted to apply it to a new type of bacteria. And so we went to her professor at the time and said, hey, we need $5,000 to basically buy reagents to test this idea. And her professor at the time said, well, it'll be impossible for you to get funding because you're undergraduates and you don't have a track record.
Basically so, said, the system doesn't fund people like you.
Exactly.
Interesting. And how about you, Skander?
Yeah, I've got a background in aeronautics and astronautics. So my studies were more to do with aerospace.
Okay, so so you gave us a little hint, but what is wrong with traditional ways of funding science?
So the current funding system is just really focused on small incremental projects. I think the way that science is funded today, there's a lot of kind of bureaucracy and sometimes politics that comes in the way. And so when you have researchers who are trying to do really innovative or maybe risky ideas, it's hard for them to get off the ground, particularly for these kind of seed stage or early stage projects. And so that's where we hope to come in, is to really kind of give these really kind of wild, risky, innovative ideas a platform. I mean, connect them with people who really care about these ideas.
Sorry, Tony, go ahead.
We're both so excited about this. We wanted to jump in. Well, I wanted to find out what is it that you're doing to let people know? I mean, I love this idea, and I love the fact that I think people will catch on. Right now, it looks like a lot of the people that are funding are people who already have projects or are teachers. How are you letting the masses know that you're there?
So a lot of what we do is trying to help researchers kind of find the right audience. And so one kind of core assumption we've had from the beginning is that for every scientific idea, whether it's like breast cancer research or digging up dinosaurs, there's a passionate audience that could care about that idea. And so a lot of what we do is really kind of training researchers with science communication to kind of find those audiences and kind of deliver their story and deliver their message. And so because of that, we've found, all kinds of passionate communities in places you wouldn't think of.
Well, one of the frustrations I've had with the funding of science is that there seems to be a heck of a lot of money in some areas of science behind vested interests, because corporations have an interest in funding science. Some governments have an interest in funding science. And so we get a lot of science that kind of supports the interests of those kinds of things, especially in the food industry. So much of the health and food related, drugs and pharmaceutical related science is actually performed by companies who make a lot of money selling a certain view of food and or drugs. Is that another goal, or is that one of the objectives of experiment.com?
That's totally something that we found, is that most people don't realize this, but for example, cancer research is actually kind of a very one-track siloed area of research. There's tons of money in it. But if you try to do something off the beaten path, or you try to do something kind of controversial, it's really hard to get support. If you're a little bit too wild, your colleagues might think you're crazy. And so there's kind of a lot of stigma with how you're supposed to do research. And so this is kind of some of the thing that we've now launched and introduced with experiment.com, is kind of bringing back this independent spirit to research. And what really that means to us is letting researchers and letting scientists kind of, do the research that they care about without agendas or restrictions or having some big agency tell them how to do the research.
Well, it sounds pretty awesome, and I wish you well in your endeavor. And we'll be keeping an eye on you guys. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Thanks.
And you can find experiment.com at, experiment.com. Well, the mobile app OpenTable revealed last night that it's going to let you pay your check through their app. A new pilot program enables users to pay for meals in just 11 restaurants in San Francisco, with more coming in the weeks ahead. To help explain all this is Harrison Weber, a journalist, editor, and designer based in New York City. Welcome, Harrison.
Thank you for having me.
So why are they doing such an extremely limited rollout, only in San Francisco and only on the iPhone?
I think that one of the key things happening here is it's a pretty old company, and they're kind of taking it slow. I think that the earliest reports of this happening are actually since last year in July. So, this has just been a very slow pilot test. It's like a huge obvious move for OpenTable. I think that they're just playing it safe.
It was announced, it was last night, that OpenTable also recently bought Ness, which helps people find the right places to eat depending on their, not just location, but their likes and dislikes and friends. Is this some sort of a push for OpenTable to not just be, hey, let me make a reservation, but to give me more information about what I want?
Certainly. They bought food spotting last year. That was a huge thing. They're clearly trying to update their offering. They're clearly trying to just really expand beyond that core reservation service. And, you know, this is just an obvious move for a new revenue stream. And Discovery will probably be more on the side of bringing people back and keeping people, you know, as loyal users.
Well, and that was my question, is why, you know, why such a limited rollout? And why just San Francisco? Why on the iPhone?
Well, certainly San Francisco, that's where they're based, and that's where, you know, San Francisco has the luxury of just getting everything early and all the experimental services in the Valley. Why on the iPhone? Probably because less developmental difficulties and just they're isolating their testing. There's no reason to expand it beyond that. One thing that I don't have an answer to is why they're taking so long to do this. And I think it's just a matter of they're a public company. They are not hackers in any way, and they're kind of inching along.
My dream as a food enthusiast and an active restaurant customer is to just go to a restaurant, walk in, order some stuff, stuff my face, and then drop my napkin like Chris Rock drops a microphone and walk out. I'd love to be able to do that. I hope they're getting to that point. I'd also like to see them reintegrated into Siri. Remember that OpenTable used to be part of Siri before Apple ripped them out of Siri. Do you have any information that this may end up back into Siri?
Actually, I do not have any information on that. I think that the best you'll get is when Apple does a better job and actually releases an API. I'm sure OpenTable will get back in there, but it probably, you know, it's not like something that would be like a special deal with Apple. As for the you know, the dream of being able to drop your napkin and then, you know, head out of a restaurant immediately, that's a common dream. Tabbed Out, Level Up, so many different companies are trying to do that. It's the same with loyalty cards. The problem is, you know, when you have 50 different people trying to do the same thing, you have 50 different standards, and then, you know, it never becomes this like popular idea. So I think that's the risk right now for OpenTable.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today. That's all very interesting. We'll be keeping an eye on that and also on your coverage of this story. Thanks again.
Thank you for having me.
You can find Harrison at harrisonweber.com.
Well, I know on TN2, our evening edition of our news here on Twit, you mentioned that LinkedIn had announced plans to buy data-driven job search startup Bright. But not just that they're acquiring it, it's for $120 million, which is LinkedIn's biggest acquisition in the history of LinkedIn. 73% of that $120 million will be in stock, 27%, which comes out to about $32.4 million, is in cash. If you're not familiar with Bright, it uses algorithms to match job seekers to new positions and uses a scoring system that's supposed to narrow down good candidates for good jobs, the right candidates for the right jobs. What's interesting about this to me is a lot of people think of LinkedIn as, oh, that's a place where you store your resume and maybe you look for a new job and that sort of thing. But LinkedIn makes the bulk of its revenue from talent solutions. That's recruiting, product groups, headhunters post jobs. They get applications. Bright was a competitor, really. Bright sort of does that same thing. So I guess, you know, on paper, it looks like LinkedIn said, let's just buy this company. Then we get their data scientists. Our algorithms get better and we can make more money based on the products that we actually already make money on.
Absolutely. I think this is really actually very big news from a platform standpoint. I mean, LinkedIn has been so quiet and they really haven't done a whole lot. And that's the biggest complaint that people have is, what are you going to do next? I mean, they launched, you know, featured stories and that sort of thing, but that hasn't really been that big of a hit. People participate, and I think the people that are featured kind of like being featured, but it really hasn't been a strategic move. This is actually really big because we have a few other players, right? You've got CareerBuilder.com. You've got Monster, who've been trying to kind of maintain their role in the space. But LinkedIn offers so much more. And I've always thought that LinkedIn really never capitalized on the opportunity they have in a very exclusive business, job searching, connectivity sort of space. So I think this is really big.
Specifically, their advantage is that they're kind of like Facebook for business. Everybody uses LinkedIn. I mean, you know, just about everybody I know who has a job uses LinkedIn. And it has been frustrating to see them not really capitalize on that. They've started to be a social network. They weren't very good social network. They've started to be a kind of a calendar, a, you know, contacts database. They're not very good at that. I'd love to see them come out with some kind of product that enables me to replace business cards with LinkedIn, with an app or something like that, and have the contact information exchanged electronically. What are they waiting for on that kind of stuff? So at least here, they're trying to deploy what they've got to enable you to actually do something.
I think LinkedIn's issue is that there are so many functionalities of LinkedIn. Most people don't even know what most of them are and certainly aren't going to pay for a business account. But having something like Bright under its umbrella, it's almost as if it is putting more emphasis on the algorithm solution and less emphasis on me figuring out how to use LinkedIn to find contacts.
Yeah.
And that's, there's just two different ways of arriving at the same goal. But still, I think LinkedIn realizes that it can't rely on its users to make the most of getting a new job. It needs to offer more functionality.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, when I was in Spain last year, I had my iPhone stolen. And there was the reason it was stolen is because the thieves could easily just take my phone and sell it, which I'm sure that's exactly what they did. But looks like California may want to do something about that.
Absolutely. Mike, California may require a kill switch on every smartphone and tablet sold in the state. State Senator Mark Lino today introduced a bill which is sponsored by San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon that would require all such devices to feature an anti-theft feature that would enable phone and tablet owners to brick the device remotely if it's lost or stolen. The law would go into effect January 1st.
That's right. And any companies selling phones without kill switches would be subject to fines of up to $2,500 for each and every device. I think this is a terrible idea, simply because if people want kill switches, then companies should offer them, as Apple is to a certain extent, and then let the market decide. Just requiring kill switches just seems like a bit of an overstretch.
You and I totally agree on that. I think, you know, and the fact that you've had your phone stolen, I mean, you could easily be on the other side of that argument. But I think anytime you require companies to do those sorts of things, let the consumer be the decision. There's an opportunity for entrepreneurship and more apps to help you find your product.
Right. And I, you know, I'm also worried about hacking. If their system is hacked, I'm not sure I'd trust the carriers or whoever would be implementing this system. I'm not sure I'd trust them to protect this so that somebody else doesn't shut me down.
You know, just to play the other side of this for a second, living in San Francisco, certainly with iPhones, but I'm sure other smartphone models are the theft is out of control. And with that, it's not just, oh, no, my iPhone. I had all these pictures on my iPhone. But there's the possibility of being hurt, and you know, there's a whole crime thing associated with this. So I understand why the idea of, hey, if we have something like a kill switch, it will deter theft. People will be, you know, be less in harm's way. That's a good thing. At the same time, it all depends on who's in control of this.
I think what would be better is, you know, those iPhone cases that have the stun guns built in. Have you heard about those?
Now you're talking.
I want to be able to do that remotely. I want to, if somebody steals my thing, I want a lever that just goes
in their pocket. Me.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Like remote mace?
That's right. Exactly.
Oh. Surprise!
You could keep hitting them.
That'll be Monday's show.
That's Give me my phone back.
Entrepreneurs, there's an opportunity out there for you. Well, GoPro is going pro, or at least going public. The action video camera maker announced this morning that it's planning to file for a public offering. The San Mateo-based company is one of many Silicon Valley startups planning to file what's called a secret IPO. A company called Box filed one last month, and of course, Twitter's IPO is famously a secret one as well. And, you know, this is a, I really love this company. This is a really, really fascinating company. It's a kind of a rags-to-riches organization. The money was raised initially by the founder, Nick Woodman, by selling beads and shell belts out of his VW van. That's how he raised the money. No Kickstarter, none of that stuff. He sold, and in fact, his business of selling belts actually inspired him to come up with the ideas of providing straps and so on to attach the cameras. And I remember when GoPro first came out, their cameras were horrible. They were just low res. I used to use one surfing and stuff like that, and they were just horrible. And then they jumped on the high definition bandwagon, improved their lenses, and now they're just the greatest cameras. And they have such a fantastic marketing scheme where they just release these videos one after another of people jumping off of mountains and things.
Oh, I
like
discovered
that.
A GoPro. It was on GoPro's YouTube page, I believe, that account. Well, it was the guy that hugs the lions. And, I mean, yeah. I don't know who that was, but it was something I discovered. It's like you start to associate GoPro with incredible people.
Yes.
It's a great camera, yeah, but it's these daredevil people who do these things that the rest of us don't do, and then all the footage looks amazing too.
It is.
And we're looking at it now. It's just incredible the footage that.
Or those are hyenas, I think, but same idea.
Well, there was a lion a minute ago.
Oh, there was. You were all with everybody
scared away by the hyenas. Well, in a follow up, you may have read recently that Google bought $750 million worth of Lenovo shares, and if so, what you read was false. If you recall, we told you about Google's sale of Motorola Mobility to Lenovo on January 29th and January 30th. In those reports, we pointed out that the deal included Google taking a roughly 5% stake in the Chinese company. The false reports about Google buying shares started with a Reuters report that misread a shareholder regulatory filing by Lenovo in Hong Kong, which listed Google with $750 million worth of Lenovo stock. But that number was simply an estimate of the maximum value of shares that Google would own if the Motorola deal is, in fact, approved, which it has not yet been. So ignore those reports. Google did not buy Lenovo stock. Well, speaking of awesome video, what's happening in the concept car world?
Well, in other news, a new concept car comes with a drone of its own. French automaker Renault, I actually think this is how you say that, is showing videos of its Quid concept off-road vehicle that has a unique feature, a drone that flies out of a special compartment in the back. The drone remote control is built into the dashboard, but it could also be controlled with a tablet or simply by setting GPS coordinates. Not sure how that would work. The drone does several jobs. It would alter the driver's traffic, tell them about obstacles ahead, and also take the video of the vehicles and off-road exploits. It's just a concept, of course, in production a car. I'm not sure what this idea would ever fly. So,
you know, I like the drone idea, but man, what an ugly car. It's based on a bird's nest. It's inspired by a bird's nest, and it just looks hideous. I had a car like that in college where the seats were held together mostly with duct tape. It looked just like that. In fact, they might have stolen my idea. You know, this is never going to happen. Let's face it. A car is never going to sell with a... Well, maybe I shouldn't say never.
The drone actually, I think, is kind of a cool idea. And I don't know about the never part on that, although that, I think, is a bit more in the future. I don't think I like the fact that the seat is in the middle. I think that would be...
The driver's in the middle, not on the left or right, you know, but it's in the middle.
It's a really awkward, you know, talk about distractions. I don't know, because you're not just in the middle, but to your point, you have somebody on either side. I don't know how I feel about that.
I don't know. I think that you'd get people who'd... I mean, can't you sort of throw your drone off and you take a really quick left and it's like, look, drone. It just seems... It seems like a bad idea.
You're not even supposed to use your cell phone in the car. What is up with the drone?
Hostile hackers are going to, you know, when somebody cuts them off, they're going to send their drone the guy. It's going to be, the future looks bleak, folks. I don't know what's going to happen in the automotive industry. Well, that's our show. Send your news tips to our email address at tnt@twit.tv or call 260-TNT-SHOW and leave a message. Also, post and upvote your favorite stories on our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. And find the rest of our social pages by searching for Tech News Today on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, and YouTube. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Tech News Today at twit.tv/TNT. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you Monday. We're supposed to be panning.
I know, panning.